Hello everyone, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright. And we are historians.
If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to season 8 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
Today on Archive Fever, we're recording a special live episode at the West Footscray Writers Festival in Nam, where we're absolutely delighted to be speaking to local author Dr. Michaela Sahar. Michaela is a writer, researcher, and lecturer in the School of Media and Communications at RMIT. She's an interdisciplinary scholar with a specific interest in Palestine studies and how it's informed by First Nations knowledge and research in both Australia and elsewhere. Michaela is also an accomplished essayist and poet whose works have been published in Cordite, Griffith Review, Meanjin, Overland, Southerly, and the Sydney Review of Books, among others. Her first book, Find Me at the Jaffa Gate, an encyclopedia of a Palestinian family, was published by New South in 2025 and has since been showered with praise and honours. It was recently awarded the Victorian Premier's Literary Award in nonfiction and was longlisted for the Stella Prize, and the shortlist and the winner are yet to come, so watch this space. As Randa Abdul-Fattah puts it, Meet Me at the Jaffa Gate is brilliantly evocative and genre-defying. It's a work of creative nonfiction that delves into gaps and blank spaces to ask, what does the daughter of a Nakba survivor inherit? Michaela, welcome to Archive Fever.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm listening to the beautiful enthusiasm of your voices for the podcast, actually, with much admiration and some trepidation that I may not be able to match your energy with your voice.
Claire and I both have ADHD. It's kind of our brand to be very high energy at all times, but, you know, balance is good. You can bring whatever energy you like.
And bring all the energy you have to the room as well. This is an intimate space that we have today. We often call this Archives Anonymous. And these are the rooms where we're here to share our confessions. And so do also bring your enthusiasm to the space as well with loud clapping at times that you feel that it's appropriate. Weeping is also appropriate.
Wolf whistling, laughing, finger clicking, just, you know, whatever you need to do. So, Michaela, we'll do a deep dive into Find Me at the Jaffa Gate in the moment. But let's begin by going back to sort of the beginning of your relationship with archives and research. As you make clear in the book, you know, you grew up in Nam as the daughter of a Nakba survivor. And there was kind of clearly a bit of a disconnect between your own knowledge of yourself as a Palestinian person from a Palestinian family surrounded by, you know, material artifacts of that culture, and the reception you often got out in the world when you told people you were Palestinian and they expressed kind of disbelief or doubt that that could be the case. Mm. I'm wondering, did that kind of dissonance between what you and your family knew and what the world told you was possible, did that have any kind of relationship or did that feed into your interest in knowledge and archives and research?
Oh, gosh, that's a sprawling and rich question. Thank you for it. I think I always think of being sort of peripheral to the mainstream as offering people a kind of superpower in terms of their insights into the world. But I don't think that I thought of this as research or as an archive, and I'll come to sort of say in a moment what I mean by that. As a young person, it felt like the kinds of things that my family had felt like the sorts of things that are easily dismissed as anecdotal, mm-hmm. as not necessarily part of a body of knowledge, certainly not as an official body of knowledge. And when I went to university, I had the good fortune of not only studying history at a time where I think history was on its ascent in Australian universities rather than in the period of decimation that it sort of faces, but I also studied creative writing. And one of the teachers that I had, who I know has been a guest on the podcast, was Tony Birch. And I think it was Tony Birch who helped me to think about the way in which particular objects can be thought of as a repository of story, whether that be the pine cone he gave me one day when I told him that I was having trouble writing, or the things from my own collection, which I perhaps didn't have a history for but became the impetus for thinking about what history that object had to tell or had to share. And it was also around the time that Tony taught me that he published one of the really influential, I guess, creative but also historical influences for me, which was his long poem, Footnotes to a History War. And so thinking about how do we delve into the archives as people who are maybe not reflected in it or represented in it or even oppressed by it, and make something of our own from that. And I know he describes that particular poem now as a kind of call and response between a kind of colonial archive and then the First Nations response or relationship to that material. So that was quite formative. And I think it was thinking about the legitimacy, if you like, maybe a self-claimed legitimacy to the objects that my family had, which were certainly not in any sense organised. You know, it's probably prior to thinking about those lessons from people like Tony, I'd thought about it as a vast ephemera, and an ephemera that also had all kinds of mysterious properties, like you'd see a photo one day and then you would never be able to find it again, because of the array of disorganisation that sort of characterised these documents, but also the fact that there are many inheritors of a family archive in a way, and so people take things and they bring them back, and, you know, things go missing, and things go missing because people's memories start to fade and they forget where they're putting things. Things go missing because someone borrows something. So that, in a rambling way, may answer the question that you posed.
And it does. And I believe you're wearing one of those objects from your family archive around your neck, which you mentioned before we came on stage, yeah. Going missing. Can you tell us about that object and maybe what it means for you to be wearing it?
Oh, this is a very new object that's come into my custody, but a very important object, which anyone who knows about the Palestinian struggle will know that the key to the family home is one of the greatly cherished symbols of return, and also of resistance, and also an affirmation of belonging to place and a fitting place and of who we are. But this is my grandfather's key to a property in what is today called West Jerusalem, in the neighbourhood of the Greek colony. And my grandfather built the house in the 1920s and 1930s. And, of course, when he left Palestine, he left with, you know, a very scant array of his possessions because of the nature of their departure. And I imagine, you know, departure stories are different. Some people leave and walk back and become what's called present absentees, that is, displaced within their own country. My family did something a little bit similar, but also eventually came to Australia. And so when they left their house, it was really a leaving of finality, although they did at some point return for a couple of years to attempt to return to Jerusalem, although this had been made impossible by the state. But my grandfather used to sit on the couch in his lounge room holding this key And he would do particular things with it when he was upset or when he was feeling joyous, you know, and he'd wave it around in particular ways to comfort himself and to remind himself, I think, of a stolen inheritance, I suppose, but also of who they were in Jerusalem and of the things that mattered. It was for some years believed by my family that this key was lost, and I believed it was lost until the day that I went to the Victorian Premier's award ceremony. And when you are told that you've won an award, you're allowed to bring a few family members. So I called my cousin and my aunt and asked if they would come along. And just before the ceremony, they presented me with this key. Which I have to tell you was almost too much. Never give someone such a valuable and important present, you know, 5 minutes before they have to get up and give a speech. But it was hugely honouring. And so, you know, this is now something I will carry and bequeath to another important family member when the time is right.
Michaela, we ask all of the guests on Archive Fever what it feels like to them when they are in the grip of Archive Fever, when they are immersed in the archives, and obviously we define archives very broadly. We've done episodes on the night sky as archive, or the Antarctic ice sheet as archive, country as archive, as well as the traditional colonial bricks and mortar boxes of files kinds of archives. So I'm wondering what it means to you to be gripped by Archive Fever in that embodied sense, particularly because you are literally wearing an archive on your body right now.
I mean, I suppose in the process of writing the book, which anyone who has read it may be surprised to learn that with one exception, it was written in the order it appears. Mm-hmm. It was not a kind of, you know, mix and match, however random it may appear. To me, there's a very strong through line in the text. So only one chapter got moved for various reasons, sort of later in the editing process. But as I wrote each chapter, and each chapter takes something specific at its heart, and a lot of those entries, as I called them, because the subtitle Encyclopedia of a Palestinian Families is actually the working title, and this is how I thought of it, as actually a kind of archive, right? Like as a kind of repository for knowledge, and in a way a repository for the kind of knowledge that is not recorded or not treasured or not valued in empire history, right? It's an anti-imperial history, perhaps. So I would sit with the objects and think about what narrative it generated, how it had come into my possession, what the stories were connected to that object, or document or photograph. But in a way, to think about the grip of Archive Fever, I think the thing that really excites me is the way that you keep circling back to particular things you learn and the story keeps building itself. And so I had a few revelations or discoveries of this nature when I was writing the book, and in a sense when I was researching for the book. One of them was that many years ago on my first trip to Amman, I was in fact just transiting on my way to Palestine, and I have had terrible luggage catastrophes across my life. My checked on luggage has been lost more times than I care to remember. And on this particular occasion, I'd arrived in Amman, was meant to travel to Palestine the next day. My luggage had been lost and I was staying with friends. And they said, well, why don't you just stay until, you know, the luggage is sort of reunited with you. And so I had never thought about visiting Amman. I had often thought about it as like Palestine's waiting room, because you want to do this sort of land border crossing rather than flying in where you might face as a person of Palestinian, you know, name and heritage, the possibility of deportation to wherever you've come from, which if it's Australia is much too far to try again. Whereas if you go on a land border, you can return the next day. And so this lovely driver had said to me, well, where would you like to go? And because I'd thought absolutely nothing about what Amman might have to offer, I said, I'd like to go to the hospital where my father was born, because my family actually left Palestine specifically because of a particular bombing and the fact that my grandmother was just about due to give birth to my father, and the hospitals were full in Jerusalem, where they're from. And so they had gone across to this hospital, which is only really an hour and a bit's drive away, and was so at the time. And so we went to the hospital, and my father had said to me he didn't have a birth certificate, and we tried to get him a birth certificate, and they were terribly helpful until I told them the year he was born, and they said, oh, my God, 1948, no, it's a mess, because, of course, all the refugee children were born in Amman that year. And when I got home, or when I got back to the place that I was staying, back to my friend's places, on the phone that I'd forgotten to take with me that day, there were two messages, one from my aunt and one from my uncle. And they both told me the story that when my grandmother gave birth to my father 10 days after she'd been obliged to leave her loved and beautiful home in Jerusalem, which she was never to return to, she'd become very sick on the night of my father's birth. And after delivering him, the nuns had asked if they would like her to put him in the nursery. And she'd fought vehemently to keep the baby, but then had sort of, you know, fallen into a fever and lost track of what had happened. And when she woke up the next morning, they told her that the nursery at the Italian hospital in Amman had burnt down. And she was quite hysterical, and they said, oh, no, but you're lucky because we kept your baby beside you because you insisted. And I was given that story because I was there. And I'd never heard it before, and my father had never heard it before. But his two oldest siblings knew it, but had never thought to tell anyone. And there are so many stories like that within the context of researching the book, that as you achieve one piece of knowledge, something else is offered. Sometimes to really challenge your understanding of what that might mean. One other story I can think of is that, again, after I came home from Palestine, my uncle, who's now sadly died, was telling me that he and my eldest aunt had walked through the debris of the area of the bombing of the King David Hotel. And again, I believe he only told me because I had walked past it and was talking to him about being there. And so he told me in some detail about this story of a little boy who played marbles who didn't go to school, and the children would see him every day playing marbles on their way to school and on their way home. And on the day of the bombing of the King David Hotel, my aunt and uncle walked past him on their way to school and they walked past him on their way home, but he had been killed. And he was blown apart on the pavement. It was a very brutal bombing. Some 92 people were killed in that bombing of the Haganah, if I'm not wrong. And the King David Hotel, for those who don't know, was the headquarters, the British Mandate at the time in Jerusalem. And my uncle, who later became a medical doctor, remembered with really anatomical detail the sight of this boy who had been killed and the fact that his marbles were rolling around in the edge of his skull. And my aunt said, I must have been there too, but now I don't remember. Mm. But she hadn't ever really remembered that story or offered it until my uncle told the story. But when I came to write the book, which was probably 10 years after he told me that story, or says, yeah, something like that, she insisted that she hadn't been there, and instead she insisted that she had been at home on her balcony watching plumes of smoke from that bombing, which I don't actually think is possible, but in her mind it was, and that she'd been sitting on the balcony eating grapes. And every time she told that story, or I discussed that story with her, she was most insistent on the grapes. And I was telling a cousin of mine who is also a doctor, a psychiatrist, she said, but obviously the grapes are the marbles. So I don't know if that's an archive fever, but it's this sort of the way that you're led through. You have a story, but as you start to populate the story or situate the story, that, you know, the small and the big, people start offering you more and more perspective on that. And also you start to hold together the contradictions of both stories and recognise that they're both important.
I guess if you extend our kind of wonky AA analogy, Archives Anonymous analogy, one doesn't become addicted to a substance, a drug or alcohol, on the first jab or the first drink. It's the accumulation of hits that is where the addiction builds up. Mm. And I guess what you're suggesting to us there is that it's one story at a time, but that's what leads you in. And that's what gets you hooked, so that you have to keep going to the places, keep asking the questions, keep digging further to get the next bit of, I don't know, what chemical it is that is released in our brains or in our hearts or in our intellects when you hear a story like the one you've just told us, Michaela.
And in a way...
that it is addictive.
Yeah, and I think in a way, and I mean, maybe that's the luxury of writing in nonfiction, but I have an understanding that the book is finished insofar as it's a published text, but that there are more stories, and it's an unfinished project and an unfinished process. And, you know, one way of describing that for me at least is that the day that I got the first copy of this book, I opened it up to the dedication page and there's a picture that I have loved dearly over many years, and it's a picture of my father in Amman at about 18 months of age. And he's standing in front of a car that my family later sold, and it became the price for their passage on a ship to Australia. But in the picture, I guess because it was slightly blown up, In the context of, you know, being placed on the dedication page, because it's a very small sort of 5x9 centimetre, you know, 1950s picture, I suddenly noticed not only my father in the book but two shadows. And I thought, you know, we didn't have pictures of my grandfather and my grandmother in Amman, but this is the picture of my grandfather and my grandmother in Amman trying to get my father to stand still at the age of 8 photos. Yeah.
Michaela, your context of these family stories and the kind of you're telling us in the counter archive you're building through them is, of course, the settler colonial project of Israel. And I guess the relationship between archives and colonialism, particularly settler colonialism, has been a kind of enduring interest of ours on this podcast, mainly focusing on this continent, on the Australian context. And, you know, as you mentioned before, we've spoken to First Nations writers like Tony Birch, Natalie Harkin, and Nathan Sentence and others about how their work seeks back to colonial archives and sort of uncovers the ways in which those archives are key technologies of the colonial project. It strikes me that there are core similarities here with your work and the way in which your relationship with Palestinian archives and your attempt to create this counter-archive is a kind of speaking back to the attempted erasure of Palestinian history and archives by the settler colonial state of Israel. Could you talk to us a bit about how you understand those parallels or not, and how you understand the relationship between archives and colonialism in the context of Palestine?
Oh, thank you for that. And actually, Natalie Harkin's work is also a great inspiration for me. I think when I, in the process of developing this book, I was lucky to get a Next Chapter Fellowship, and my mentor was Wiradjuri writer Dr. Janine Lane, and at that time she gave me an article that she and Natalie had done, which was really a dialogue about the archives in a book called Law's Documents. and they're thinking about what happens when you're either documented extensively by a kind of colonial entity, or you're scarcely documented. And I can't remember which was which, but you know, one of them had just tons of files pertaining to the history of their family, and one had a very scant array. And thinking about, you know, what do we make of these things? What, you know, what is the coloniality at play in both of those archival, you know, artifacts in a way? I suppose there's a few different ways to approach this question, and I'm trying to sort out in my mind. I got an email yesterday saying we're not going to send you the questions because we like to keep it fresh, so I'm casting around for what the best place to start. I think it's very true to say that Israel has a very good understanding of the power of archives because of the way that they have treated Palestinian documentation since 1948. And so to give you sort of one lineage of the example of that, at various points, you know, Palestinian organisations or political governmental organisations moved archives to sort of nearby places, and one of those places was in Lebanon. And during the massacres of Sabra and Shatila in 1982, the IDF, or the Israeli military, confiscated the archives of the PLO in Beirut. What was in those archives were maps, titles, and evidence of Palestinian ownership of 97% of the entirety of their homeland. Why do you steal them? Because you want to erase the memory of the memory, in a way. But we see this consistently over time. So similarly, in 2002, when again, actually at the time, although it's, you know, obviously a time of enormous conflagration right now, including in the West Bank, which isn't reported on often enough. But in 2002, which is often called sort of the last big ground invasion of the Israeli military into the Palestinian occupied territories, the Ministry of Education in Ramallah was also ransacked, right? Now, again, why? Because it is a repository of archives of knowledge, of, you know, cultural ephemera, of the sorts of things that keep identities, that keep genealogies and lineages of who we were before 1948 alive. And in Gaza, the burning of the universities and the libraries.
Scholasticide, Anthony Lowenstein called it when we spoke to him a couple of years ago on this show.
That's right. Yes, although very important not to forget that that is also occurring in the West Bank. And so, you know, the University of Beer Zeit struggles to get academics to come and teach there. At one point in the horrifying catalogue of things that Israel has done to curtail Palestinian, you know, education life, Israel said at one point that it would only allow in scholars that it approved to teach at the University of Beer Zeit. I mean, you know, it's so it's very difficult to, and actually to think about Lowenstein's book, there's an excellent book by Nick Reimer. And I always muddle up its title, but it's called something like Academic Boycott and the Struggle for, or Boycott Theory and the Struggle for Academia, or something like this. But the first chapter, which is a very, very painful chapter to read, elaborates on the enormous difficulty for Palestinian people to receive an education. And it's not just the really dramatic stuff. It's all the little stuff. It's about movement in place. Palestinian children may spend up what you might consider to be a working day just travelling to and from school because of the nature of the checkpoints, never mind whether or not they get the school day, right? And it's just this accretion of delay and difficulty, which leads then to what another scholar, Sari Hanafi, and there's a lot of sides, unfortunately, in the Palestinian context, but has called spatiocide, that people wish to leave because life becomes unlivable. And so people make decisions about, you know, whether they can stay in place or whether they need to make other decisions for the future prospects of things like the education of their children. So there's that lineage, if you like, of the history of the attack of Palestinian education and of Palestinian archive. But also there is, of course, the way in which Israel itself has handled its own archive. And so it has a deliberate state policy, actually, of obscuring in all kinds of ways the information about what happened in 1948 and afterwards. That has been done by, so at times they have opened up archives, and there was, of course, the moment of great revisionism in the same way that there was in the Russian archives, you know, in the 80s, and we call them Israel's new historians, and, you know, people like Ilan Pappe are associated with that movement. And that was a moment of archival opening where they had access to, you know, papers, state papers from, you know, 1948 at that point. Later on, I remember Ilan Pappe talking about, you know, documents that were made available about 1967. And for those who don't know, 1967, the Six-Day War, is when, if you like, all of historic Palestine is reunified under the umbrella of Israel, and Israeli occupation across the entire territory. I hope I haven't confused people with the way I've described it. But in any case, some of his research said 1948 was always meant to do what 1967 ultimately did. And you can see in the papers from 1963 that were opened up at a particular moment that basically the plans were in place. They were just waiting for the right moment. They were waiting for the possibility of doing what they ultimately did. However, since then, a lot of those documents, even heavily redacted, have also been re-disappeared through the archive. And this happens in different ways, and I can't speak authoritatively to all of that, but I did have a friend working on a history of Palestinian theatre, which is by its nature quite an ephemeral thing to be writing a history on, but he was relying on a lot of documents that when he was then at the point that he wanted to publish the book, they were no longer there because they'd been re-scattered through the archives in ways that thwarted attempts to find the materials. Yeah.
And it strikes me, Michaela, that, you know, in a way this book is your answering back to that sort of Israeli destruction, erasure of Palestinian archives by building this new archive in the form of an encyclopedia. In one of the early chapters, you sort of speak about it as a process of unfragmentation, you know, bringing back together these stories and people scattered through diaspora and exile. I wanted to zoom into that choice to call it an encyclopedia, because I've heard you say elsewhere you really deliberately resisted the framing of memoir because so often disenfranchised, dispossessed people are only allowed to write memoirs and are only positioned as kind of survivors with testimony, whereas calling your work an encyclopedia is a claim to expertise and authority and knowledge. Can you talk to us about the thinking behind that?
Sure. I mean, the memoirs come later. I never sat down and thought I'm writing a memoir. I mean, I think it's you've got to be quite famous or quite old to be person.
I mean, I was neither, and I did.
Or something extraordinary.
Just had enormous hubris.
But, I think if you read the book, the only way you could understand it as a memoir is really as a sort of anti-memoir or as a sort of polyphony of people's stories and different voices that exist in the book. To follow on from the last question, it is a book that obviously has an understanding of the framework of a history, But I think Palestinian people, and for many years this was a very explicit decision, when Palestinian people were invited to speak, they were invited to speak in dialogue always. You could only have a Palestinian speak if you also had maybe a progressive Zionist hop up and speak with you. And so the conversation was already framed in a very particular way. And Palestinians often ask themselves, you know, when do we get to think about our own rich cultural histories and narratives, or indeed our own experience of tragedy, of catastrophe, as we call, you know, the Nakba in English is catastrophe. When do we get the opportunity to narrate that without having to hold the story of our oppressors, if you like? You know, and there's a really wonderful Palestinian older scholar who has created some amazing sort of atlases of the destroyed villages of Palestine, Dr. Salman Abu Sitar. And I remember hearing him very early in the genocide saying, you know, Palestinian people are so often asked, but if you want your homes back, what would happen to the people who are in them? And he says, but, you know, it's a shockingly racist premise to imagine that the victims should come up with a solution for their own oppressors of what is to be done with them.
Michaela, would you like to read the words on the back of the T-shirt that I'm wearing?
Oh, sure.
For those who are not in the room, Eve and Michaela and I are all wearing Readers and Writers Peace, the genocide T-shirts, a wonderful support group that has worked in solidarity. Were they all have so words on the back of them. You want to read the one
that's
on mine? And
this is the text by the wonderful Randa Abdul-Fattah. And she says, since when do the victims of genocide have the responsibility to defer to and protect the feelings of those who enact, support and enable their genocide? Mm. Very much so. But that's what Palestinian people are often requested, and people think that's reasonable, you know, and still people think that's reasonable because we spend a lot of time talking about feelings rather than rights, you know. Yeah. Was there a question?
I want to go back to this question.
The memoir. Yeah.
Rather than the person getting a testimony in the form of memoir, building your own archive as an authority.
Yes. I mean, I think, look, there's a sense, I did a doctorate and I realised sort of about a year before I finished it that part of its power or part of its value was the way that it performs an authoritative stamp on what you have accumulated, you know, what repository of knowledge you've sort of built up. And there are not very many people in Australia with, you know, doctorates in Palestine studies or Palestinian narrative. And I mean, you know, the media does not or rarely consults people with expertise. And there's sort of this idea, and I see it happening in a number of different, you know, frameworks, but I feel like people who are not part of a mainstream dominant culture are often asked to be witnesses, or to offer, you know, I have an ambivalent relationship to the term lived experience, but I offered to sort of parade some sort of lived experience about something. But this is sort of minimised or marginalised through its idea of anecdotalness. And it's also, I mean, there's a tension here too, of course, and, you know, this is a bigger question about the methodologies of history. But oral histories are very important. And so one thing I would say about Palestinian histories is that there are certainly things that I've heard from a number of sources that I've never been able to find written down, but I believe the sources, I believe the tellers. And in a sense, even if they're not accurate, to think in an Alessandro Portelli sort of way, they are telling me about the meaning of what they're telling me about, even if it's not the fact of the thing. So I thought that was quite an important aspect of the project, to assert a kind of expertise and also to assert an authority over the construction of Palestinian history. But the other important thing actually about this book, which we haven't touched on, certainly important for me in the construction of it, is I think the Palestinian diaspora, of which I am a part of, the Palestinian diaspora sort of disappears at both ends of its story. It's disappeared by Israel, but it's disappeared in the place it arrives. For all kinds of reasons, it's not just the external reasons, it's also the internal community reasons of, you know, I think quite early in the book, I talk about going to school and, you know, it's the time of the first intifada and my teacher imagines that I've said something really quite shocking when I tell her that my name is a Palestinian name. And to mitigate that, my mother said, well, you know, you could say you're Middle Eastern because, of course, no one likes conflict, right? Like there's a... Most people don't want a confrontation about who they are. And, you know, ironically enough, it was actually because of the first intifada that one of my aunts started telling everyone she was Palestinian because she was just so proud of their resistance. But also because what people often forget is that the first intifada, for whatever its successes and failures were, it was a PR disaster for the Israelis. And Yitzhak Rabin, who has been remembered as sort of the peace prime minister who was later assassinated, but he was actually, he had a different role at the time, and I think it might have, obviously there's not a ministry called head of PR, but that was, I think, effectively his role at that time. And there's plenty of quotes from the guy saying, this has been a PR disaster for Israel, we have to wrest back the narrative and control it. Because people could finally see that you had tanks against 12-year-olds with stones and that was the nature of occupier and occupied, not of two equal sides in some sort of military conflict. Yeah.
Michaela, that experience of the sort of the double disappearance of going into exile and dispossession of your people and then becoming a migrant, immigrant, a refugee, and then also the lure of the safety of assimilation is something that I've experienced myself as a Jewish Australian. And one of the ways in which I have routinely been disappeared is that people say to me all the time when they find out I'm Jewish, oh, you don't look Jewish, which is, by the way, one of the most anti-Semitic things that you can say. But that form of erasure is what both leads to a kind of self-censorship because you become aware that it is safer to melt back into the background in some way. I was always told as a child, don't ever tell anybody you're Jewish because it might just make a difference. And so you don't want to. That's the passing helps. Yeah. So that you're not discriminated against. But then there comes a time where actually standing out becomes important as well, and that's what telling your story is, and that's why words become important, and that's why Jews who were dispossessed in the Holocaust so often have told their stories. My mother, who's in the audience today, was an editor of a series of books that the Macor Jewish Library in Melbourne put together that was literally called Write Your Story. And there doesn't seem to me in that to have been the same need to have an authority to tell that story. So I wonder whether there's a passing of time from the Holocaust, which is completely a legitimate form, source, origin of storytelling. Do you think that in time the Palestinian story will be one that can be proudly told, the Palestinian story of exile, of dispossession, particularly coming out of the genocide of Gaza, in Gaza now, whether it's a process of time, of more decades and time needs to pass before you will need to have a sense that you have an authority that has to be based on archives, on legitimate things, before you can and your people can tell your story. Or whether there's a racism, just inherently there's a racism in there that is stronger than anti-Semitism, that mitigates against that.
I mean, the Nakba happens 3 years after the Holocaust finishes. Mm. So I don't think it's about time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's about European appetite, Western appetite, imperial appetite. I'm not an expert on the Holocaust, so I don't want to say too much about it, but it seems to me that that you're talking about people who are part of a European society who are genocided. In the Palestinian case, you're talking about people who are not part of a European polity, who are the collateral, you know. And, of course, as you would know, the Holocaust looms over that too. It's often described as sort of a justification for the colonisation of Palestine. Of course, it's a good story to tell, and it's an emotionally satisfying one for some people, but it's very far from the truth. I mean, things are in train much earlier. The Balfour Declaration happens in 1917. Theodore Herzl writes his magnum opus, The Jewish State, in 1896. So, you know, there's a very different trajectory, actually, to how a political ethno-nationalist movement of Zionism ends up in a state that has very little to do with the Holocaust, but although it becomes the cover for that. I think one of the difficulties for Palestinian people, but I really remember reading the introduction to Norman Finkelstein's book, The Holocaust Industry, and it's very moving. It's a personal anecdote that he tells about his mother and the fact that after the Holocaust, people really didn't care that the Holocaust had happened. And it was a couple of things in broader culture. Maybe we need an historian of public engagement, Claire, for the Palestinian people. But, you know, that both the trial of Eichmann, which I believe was broadcast, sort of the testimonies from the trial, and also, and you know, very much a show trial rather than a legal process, as many trials come to be that sort of end up being tried in a more public court, but very, very powerful in, you know, a bit more like a Truth and Reconciliation type commission in terms of the power of public narrative and the power of, you know, telling your story and having it heard and acknowledged. And that's what Palestinian people haven't had. But the other thing that really helped, according to the sort of Finkelstein narrative there, was Hollywood and specifically Paul Newman starring in the film Exodus. Yeah.
They similar story with Arthur Haley and Roots. They say that it was that entering into the slavery entering into the popular consciousness in that way really changed and started an archival industry in slavery histories as well.
But you know, I've said that it's not about time. It's about racism, visibility, platforming, all these sorts of things. But what I would say is I started writing as a Palestinian person who was interested in writing about Palestine as a student, and no one was very interested in publishing that stuff. And I'm not sure, I look back at some of it and it's like, I don't think it's that it was unpublishable. I think there was no appetite. And in the last 3 or 4 years, we've had a number of Australian Palestinian authors being published, which is fantastic. There is a shift to who's interested, who's listening, even if it's a small shift. But just to see even, you know, 5 or 6 authors having their books, you know, in public circulation and as part of a national conversation is a huge change, I think. Yeah.
There is, you know, definitely that change with, you know, people like Randa Abdel-Fattah, yeah. Hissi Pirani, Sarah Salah and others. But I guess, you know, your book has also come out at a time of growing censorship of Palestinian voices and growing repression of the Palestinian movement in the context of the genocide. Mm. I know you wrote most of this book before the genocide began in 2023. How has kind of publishing the book in this sort of perhaps unforeseeable context of genocide, repression, but also heightened visibility of Palestine. How has it sort of changed your relationship to the book, if at all?
I mean, I edited it.
You did, okay. Yeah.
So the book had been written before the genocide began, but I edited it during that time, I think the structure of the book is in many ways accommodating of the genocide, but I think that tells you about the long history of the Palestinian story that I didn't need to rewrite the book to accommodate the catastrophe of what's happening now. And actually, the contrary, I feel like Palestinian people have been saying for years, you know, decades, there will be a genocide.
Yes, it's not inevitable.
Yeah.
It was, yeah.
So I guess there were a few shifts that I made. I mean, actually, the T-shirt I'm wearing on the back has the words of a Palestinian cultural producer and writer in Gaza. His name is Mahmoud Al-Shah, and I encourage everyone to find his work and seek it out. He's edited collections. He's written his own book. But we had been writing for a number of years before the genocide began. And I did end up including in the book, this question of overwhelm. How do you talk about Palestine in the face of a genocide? And I think the answer is this: you can't understand what's happened in 2023 or 4 or 5 or even now under the so-called ceasefire, when still, you know, hundreds of people have been assassinated and many more have starved to death. Or not being able to access medical care. You can't understand where that has come from unless you understand what happened in 1948 and earlier. And so that, for me, was the way that it became possible to talk about this book while honouring people who have lost their lives there or have fought so hard for their lives there. But, there's a chapter in the book where I quote Mahmoud. I remember him writing to me once and just saying, "Remember us." Mm. And so, in a sense, the book is an honouring or a remembering of all of us. Mm.
Michaela, usually when we do these live Archive Fever events at writers' festivals, we have two guests, and even I are able to wind things through two authors. We decided against that today because we knew there was so much to talk about in your book that we wanted to just have you, and I think it's shown that we could continue. There's so much more. I really encourage people to buy this book. We haven't had much of an opportunity to talk about the form of its writing and also its extreme literary merit. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. Congratulations. But we can't let you go without asking something that we ask all of our guests in Archive Fever, which is, do you have a dirty little archive secret you'd like to tell us?
I don't think my answer is going to amuse, and I'm not even sure if it's an archive secret, but I suppose, in a sense, because I'm twisting together in my work the archives of so many people, the narratives of so many people, that I undertook a really sprawling ethics process when I was finishing my book, and I tried to send it, if anyone was named, I tried to send them either the whole manuscript or the chapter that they were named in. And some people took that very seriously and very carefully went through and, you know, checked. And my experience, at least of my family, but I think it's quite a Palestinian thing, is people often don't write back in a very timely way. And when I say in a not very timely way, it could be like well over 6 months or even some years before you hear back in response to a question you've posed. And so I'd sent a chapter to a cousin of mine, and he was away, and we'd had it. He said, "I'm going to read it tomorrow morning." And I said, "Great." And he was in Athens. And I never heard back from him, and I thought, I sort of prompted him. He said, no, I got it. And then the day after the book went to print, he wrote. And I thought, my God, there's nothing I can do about it now. But he simply said, "I'm so honoured you've included me in your story, and I'm really proud to be your family."
Oh, that's lovely. If that had have gone the other way,
yeah, I would have said, I think all academics who undertake oral history probably have some dirty little ethical secrets hiding behind there.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us, Michaela. It's just an absolute honour to speak to you and hear your profound wisdom about all these topics. And good luck for the Stella Prayers. And I'm sure this book will be receive many other plaudits and shortlistings and prizes. So I look forward to seeing that play out over this year.
Oh, thank you so much to you both for the very thoughtful way that you've engaged with my work. I really appreciate it.
To learn more about Michaela and her work, you can buy Meet Me at the Jaffa Gate from your local independent bookstore, or if you're here today at the Westlands Grey Arts Festival, you can get it from the Festival Hub, where you can also find all this fabulous Readers and Writers Against the Genocide merchandise on the table.
And that's what all the cool kids are wearing at the festival. You can follow Claire on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve_Rees. And don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1 through 7 via the website archivefeverpod.com. And you can also listen and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you choose to listen to your podcasts, and also do that little rate and review thing that helps us move things along with our peak nerd audience.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
And our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Under our